From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studio in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining me. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time. During the pandemic shutdown especially, and then ongoing since then, we've been talking to a lot of different healthcare professionals, to a lot of different public officials, and approaching people's reactions to the pandemic in different ways. Today, we're approaching it from a very reflective point of view. We have several authors with us who are all part of a wonderful project called Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. It's a book that has been edited by B.J. Hollers, who's an English professor at UW-Eau Claire and an author. With us are also several people who are contributors to the book, folks from the greater La Crosse area and beyond, and I'm glad to have them with us today. I'll introduce each one of them in due course, but joining BJ are Matt Cashin, Tracy Schult-Hellison, Amanda Ziba, and Rafael Francisco Salas, and I'm so glad to have all of them with us. First of all, BJ, on behalf of everybody else, I guess, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thank you so much for having us, Ezra.
So Hope is the Thing. It's the title of this book, and it strikes interesting reminders of Emily Dickinson. Tell me how you came up with the name for this book.
Well, you know, I was reading some Emily Dickinson. You know, I think back to March 2020, and I think we all have this moment of a fractured understanding of what was going on. No one quite knew what to do with themselves except to, you know, stay inside, wash your hands, stay 6 feet apart. And so as I was kind of floundering alongside so many others, I just kept asking myself, you know, how can I stay connected with the people I care about? And what can I do in my position as a writer to try to connect voices from across the state? And it started at kind of as a Western Wisconsin thing. I run an organization called the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. So I kind of put the call out here in Western Wisconsin first. My inbox was flooded with folks who wanted to riff off the Hope is the Thing with Feathers title, which is, of course, Emily Dickinson's title, and just replace the with feathers with wherever they were finding hope at that particular moment. So that was sort of the prompt. And one writer came in, then two, and then three. And then before I knew, we had 100 writers from across the state all reflecting on where they were finding hope during this moment.
It's amazing. So how long did it take? I mean, from that initial idea, how long did it take until you really thought, hey, we've got a book here?
It's funny. In some ways, it was the easiest book I've ever written because I just outsourced the work to 100 other writers across the state, you know, but that was sort of the fun part. People often joke, you know, editing a book is like herding cats, you know, as they say, and no disrespect to writers or cats, you know, but I found this to be an incredibly exciting proposition. You know, the writers, first off, and when I say writers, I mean writers of all stripes, people who have never published before, people who've published several books and have major prizes, truck drivers, 80-year-olds, eighth graders, everyone in between, you know, so that was a big part of this. But to answer your question, it took probably from March until July of 2020 to really realize we had something special here that we wanted to share with the wider world.
That's BJ Hollers. He's the editor of Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. We've got several of the authors within that book joining us today on the show. One of them is Rafael Salas, Rafael Francisco Salas. He's an artist and an author, an art professor at Ripon College. And his work in this book is called Hope is the Work It Takes. Rafael, how did you, you're not in Western Wisconsin, how did you first hear about this project?
Yes, well, thanks so much for having me, Ezra. And to answer your question, BJ reached out to me. I'm an arts writer. I identify mainly as a painter, but I do write art criticism, and BJ reached out to me about the project. I was very excited to join up.
So you come at it from a little bit different perspective, writing not being your main deal, or at least your driving force at all times. How do you approach reflecting on the pandemic just as a more visually oriented artist?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think the vehicle of either whether it be writing or whether it be a sort of visual response to whatever the world sort of shows us or demonstrates to us, in this case, the pandemic, creative problem solving and visual art or writing sometimes is perhaps the most effective way, I think, to respond to the world events, because the creative response is sometimes the most intimate, the most visceral, and the one that people can respond to the best. You know, so I find, you know, that these types of products that we create can really be the driving force of how we describe the world to ourselves. And I really see them as very parallel.
The work that you were involved in the last year and a half, or almost 2 years since COVID kind of hit our area, do you find yourself painting like literally about pandemic themes or something? That seems like, even as I say it might be a little bit ridiculous. Or like how is your work influenced by something that you're not necessarily specifically painting or specifically writing about? Mm-hmm.
I think you hit it on the head. It sounds sort of strange to say, like, what is a pandemic theme? What is it to sort of respond to a pandemic? In my artwork, I really think about it in oblique ways. You know, for example, my artwork doesn't have like figures with masks on it or something so literal. But I would say that the work really feels right. There's sort of an emotional key or chord that really sort of feels just at the right stage or at the right moment. I'm not looking for literal imagery. I'm looking for how I feel at this time. And that's something that I explore, and it's very mysterious. I mean, I can't tell you exactly what it is that is the right key, but I kind of know it when I see it.
Know it when you see it. And your work in this piece, in Hope is the Thing, your work is called Hope is the Work It Takes. Tell me how that idea started to form.
I grew up on a farm in central Wisconsin, and it, in many ways, I think that's the answer. You know, my mom is a lifelong farmer. She runs a farm by herself in about 45 minutes north of here from Ripon. And that being the case, I mean, life is very pragmatic at some level. You know, chores need to happen. The sun comes up, that work takes place, and the sun goes down. And within that, there's a deep amount of sort of spirit and solace, I think, but really it's about very mechanical and pragmatic decisions. And so I grew up sort of doing that work. And so when I think about how to love my family and love the world and help, it is always about what my hands can do in many ways.
There's a huge lesson in there about anything overwhelming, but particularly the pandemic. I mean, sometimes it just do the next thing.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was those lessons, I think, that you know, my family and my mother in particular brought to me growing up, that love is really communicated through tasks, for lack of a better word.
Tracy Hellickson is with us as well. Tracy's piece in Hope is the Thing is called Hope is This Moment. Tracy Schulte Hellickson, I should say. Tracy, talk about how you came to be part of this group project.
Sure. So I am a member of the Mississippi Valley Writers Guild. And one of the ways that we stayed connected during the pandemic is that we had critique group meetings every other Monday. And on one of those Mondays, my critique group leader said, "Hey, Chippewa Valley Writers Guild is doing this project," and explained the project. And that's really how I learned about it. And actually that same night, looked it up and was inspired to write again, which I hadn't been doing for a while during the beginning of the pandemic.
I was about to ask whether you had been writing, but this was a prompt for you to get to pick the pen back up, I guess.
Yes. And what Raphael was saying resonated so much with me, because it was really a way to think, you know, small steps or, you know, one thing I could do. Because I think, like so many other people during the pandemic, when I thought big picture, it was overwhelming. But to be able to think about this one thing I can do, there was a lot of solace in that.
Tracy, you have written not only for adults, but for young readers as well. How do you approach a project like this differently with that experience, or like maybe with that experience, how would you recommend people who are trying to encapsulate an issue like this for younger readers whose understanding of the world is maybe not as big as it will be?
That's a really good question. I think it starts with, like it is for really writing for anyone, is meeting them where they are. So thinking about, you know, what is their experience in this, and then how can I connect through that experience? So it might not be again, big picture, it might be in the small things, like I haven't been able to see my best friend for 2 weeks. So how do we start there and connect in that way? So to find concrete experiences and be able to connect with those through the writing, I think can be helpful.
That's Tracy Schulte-Hellickson. We've also been speaking with Rafael Salas and BJ Hollers in this segment. Rafael, I know we're going to be bidding farewell to you pretty early in our conversation, and I'm hoping to hear from all of the authors here, get them to read a little bit of their work for us. So before we take our first cutaway, would you mind sharing a little bit of your piece, Hope is the Work It Takes?
Absolutely. I'd be honored to. I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning and a little bit from the end, so you'll have to buy the book to get the middle.
Uh-oh. It's a cliffhanger, I guess.
That's right. So the title of my piece is called Hope is the Work It Takes. Grandma has moved to the farm, my mother's farm, to be clear. You wouldn't assume to encounter a farm managed entirely by the likes of my mom. She's tiny, about 4 feet, 10 inches in boots, and will be in her 70th year this summer. But she's stringy, as strong as anyone I know. To add a nonagenarian matriarch into life on the farm is quirky, like a pairing from some novel. This all stems from the onslaught of the virus, of course. My family pulled my grandmother out of her retirement facility right before it was locked down. We feel lucky that she's safe or safer. We hope for the best. When I see my mom and my grandmother now reunited on the farm, I continually think about these strange times as global and national crises of illness, racial unrest, and political upheaval shake the very foundation of our lives. Mom quietly cares for her own mother who has reached her twilight. It isn't easy. Grandma may never return to her old life. The farm may be her last home. My mother knows this, and with equanimity offers her hardened hands to tend both her flock and her ailing mother. Still, they stand together, side by side, tending all that they can.
Wow, thank you. Hearing you, hearing your words about your grandmother and the gravity of what the world was about to go through around the time that your family was making the decisions that they were, I'm interested to know what was the thought process bringing your grandmother out of that living situation versus deciding whether it would be, you know, you couldn't have visited her but leaving her in where the level of care might have been different. What was that like as a family making those decisions at that time?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the decisions that we went through as a family, you know, are probably familiar to all of us, right? I mean, it's my grandmother has needs, as you said, they have medical needs, of course, but taking her out of that facility offered her the ability to, you know, interact with her family, which of course is at some level equally as important. You know, some of the decisions we had to navigate were dire. You know, what would be worse for her ultimately, to be away from her family or to contract the virus and perhaps die in her mid-90s? I mean, she's in her mid-90s. You know, they were very difficult and somewhat troubling decisions to make. But I will let you know that my grandmother's doing just fine.
That's fantastic.
So that's great news.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Your piece also touched on, you know, it's not just the pandemic that our country and really our state in particular was dealing with during the last couple of years. We had racial tension that was coming to a head during all of this as well, and we're experiencing some of the aftermath even this week of those events that happened during the pandemic, during the trial that's going on in Kenosha right now. So what was it like focusing on a pandemic that is a unique experience for those of us who are alive now, but also in the midst of all of this other turmoil and chaos and hardship, processing those things simultaneously?
Yeah, Ezra, you know, I think that it is a lot, and it's interesting to sort of reflect on it now, you know, because everything's happening so much in the moment, right? I guess I feel lucky in that I'm a teacher. And so even though, you know, as we all know, those of us who are teaching, it's been a weird year or so in the classroom or out of the classroom. But I feel lucky in the fact that I have that outlet because I needed to sort of bring the world to my students. So I had to process what was going on in my life and with my family and actually try to communicate that to my students and to be vulnerable with them, because of course they're experiencing trauma in the same way, and perhaps even more so as young people. So bringing the world of racial justice and bringing the world of the election year and the world of the pandemic to them, and bringing those discussions to the table in a way that they could kind of interact with and deal with them, was really important to me and helped me to process it too, because I had to sort of keep my head above water with them, you know?
Rafael Francisco Salas is an artist. He's also a contributing author to Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. Rafael, thank you very much for being with us today.
Honored to join you, and thank you so much, Ezra and BJ. And nice to meet you all as well.
Certainly. Tracy Hellickson, you've also heard in this segment. BJ Hollers here. He's the editor of Hope is the Thing. Matt Cashin and Amanda Ziba are also contributors to that book, and we'll hear from them coming up in the program as it continues. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you would like to, get in touch with our show, you can send us an email. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. We'll continue in just a moment on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. We're talking about Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. It is a brand new book featuring, I think 100 different contributing authors, and the editor and several of the authors are with us today. BJ Hollers is the editor. He's associate professor of English at UW Eau Claire, and part of the and the one of the founders, in fact, of is oh now I've forgotten it. Is the Chippewa Valley Writers Group, BJ?
You got it. Perfect.
Nailed it. So and we're also going to Tracy Hellickson. We heard from her earlier. We're going to be introducing Matt Cashin and Amanda Ziba in this segment. BJ, I wanted to get your input on just another question about the book in general. As you're getting these pieces from all of these different authors, they're using the prompt "Hope is," you know, whatever hope is during this period of pandemic life for them. What themes did you see recurring, regardless of what somebody might have said? Hope is this, hope is this, hope is this. What recurring themes came about in the work as you assembled it?
That's a great question, you know, and reflecting on it now, those themes are sort of a little easier to see, of course. We've got kind of the renewal of things like gardening and being outside with nature, and these sorts of things certainly came up a lot. But as you pointed out last segment, speaking with Rafael, an interesting kind of shift in what I was seeing occurred, you know, in June of that year, you know, and suddenly social justice is at the foreground of everything that we're talking about in this country at that moment. And so the topics for hope in many ways turned more difficult to come by. A lot of writers really struggled to find hope at all in that particular moment. It was a convergence of so many problems, environmental crises, social justice crises, a pandemic on top of it, you know, furloughed people, parents not sure how to take care of their kids when there's no school, all of these things, you know. And so the hope, it kind of hit a bit of a standstill, you know, and there was, I think, that rallying moment in March and April, we're going to get through this together. And then it was clear that we didn't feel like we were together at all for a long time, you know, and so I think that reckoning was really reflected in the work we got.
Amanda Ziba is with us today, and Amanda is the purveyor of Word Nerdopolis online, and the books that Amanda has written include the Champion Chocolatier series, Amanda's piece in this book is called "Hope Is the Thing I Deliver." Amanda, tell me how. Tell me about "Hope Is the Thing I Deliver."
Right. So first of all, thanks for having me. Super excited. It's my first time on WPR. For me, you know, I'm a fixer. Like I see a problem and I'm like, all right, well, what are we going to do about it? And I cannot sew masks and I am not a healthcare worker. And I just felt like there were so many things that I couldn't do. But I'm a writer. And I love sending mail. And so my piece is all about finding or sending hope in small ways. And for me and my family, that came a lot in the form of letters and cards and pictures and pen paling and trips to the mailbox.
That sounds like fun. I remember when I lived out of town until a couple of years ago, I was pen pals with my little niece. And it was always so fun to know that somebody had thought enough to write a little note, a little card, draw a little picture, and send it to me in the mail. Even though we have, you know, 1,000 different ways to stay in touch with each other, it's just a nice thing to do. Were you able to hear from any of the people that you interacted with back in that way during this time about how that made them feel to be part of that kind of correspondence?
Yeah. The great thing about sending mail is a lot of times you get mail back. And it like starts kind of this chain reaction. And not only did I think those people sent letters back to me and my family, but you know, it might've prompted them to do the same to other people and send other things. My husband and I are both teachers and we have elementary aged kids. And so we were all four home a lot all together. And so you're saying like many different, you know, ways to send messages. And so for a long time, we would bike our letters over to our pen pal who was just across town. But by biking the letters there, rather than putting them in the mailbox, we could get a quicker turnaround time, you know, between each other, and also get outside and get some physical activity. So it was really a highlight for us.
Matt Cashin is an English professor at UWL. He's been on this program before. His works include Our 13th Divorce and Lost Words of the Holy Ghost. And his contribution to this project is Hope is a Lost Peanut Floating Down the Kickapoo. Matt, that's quite an image.
Well, hi, Ezra. Yeah, and thanks for having me on. I hope that peanut is still out there. You know, that's hopeful for me. It's you know, floating my way. I'm going to find it one of these days. So I have hope, you know. But yeah, you know, this was an interesting assignment. I thought of it as an assignment because it was so challenging in this year, of course, 2020. And gosh, where is hope? Where can we find hope? And so I appreciated BJ's, you know, ambitious sort of outlook on this project. I'd known BJ for a little while and I knew how ambitious he was and what sort of good work he has done before. And so I took it upon myself to try to find some hope somewhere. And I was up against this deadline and wasn't finding it anywhere during that year so far in the first half of the year. You know, as we all know so well, it was tough. But then, yeah, one weekend, my wife Heather and I loaded up our kayaks and we went to Vernon County and we met up with some friends of ours and we went to the Kickapoo River and found some hope there, you know, as BJ said, and getting outside and, you know, having some intimate connections with nature, of course, during this time in this beautiful place where we live is definitely restorative. And yeah, a person I met on that trip, or actually I knew him. Known her before, but I saw her again, was this 6-year-old girl, the granddaughter of some friends of ours who went on this trip with us. And so I found some hope through her and some dialogue that we had, you know, when in doubt, look to the children, right?
That sounds good. Yeah. When in doubt, look to the children. It's they have a, children have a sense of what's important and they have a sense of, they have a sense, don't they, of not letting these big, huge things that are beyond their control really, really bother them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the best I could hope for is not to do any harm and let this, this, you know, 6-year-old who has this beautiful imagination sort of inspire me a little bit and to remind me what is important, remind me how to have fun and how to play around. And also just witnessing her generosity of spirit was inspiring, you know. So that's what happens sometimes. I get too old and maybe too cynical and have to remind myself, courtesy of small children, what it's like to really, you know, be sincere and generous and imaginative and playful and all those wonderful things.
I think everybody we're talking to today, in addition to being writers in their own right, are also teachers of others. Tracy Schulte Hellickson, certainly a teacher. How have you noticed your students facing this pandemic in their work?
Gosh, I said a few different times during the pandemic as I was teaching from home that my students are my heroes, because I was working with students who were working in healthcare. So, you know, they were putting in long days and then they were coming home and had, you know, their own families to care for. And they were still kind of pursuing whatever that dream was with their education as well. So I just saw them balancing so much and just really admired, you know, everything that they were doing. And, you know, as educators, I think we were all trying to be, as educators, as flexible as possible to, you know, as students were working through that.
So. Your piece in this in this work is called "Hope Is This Moment." Talk about that.
So, as I mentioned before, and part of the reason why Raphael's information resonated so much with me is that when I thought big picture, it was overwhelming. But when I could focus in on a particular moment, I found a lot of peace in that, and even found that I was valuing those moments so much more during the pandemic because I wasn't taking them for granted. And that really is what the piece was about. It's about baking cookies.
Baking cookies. That sounds good. That's the very this moment. So how is that for you as a person facing all of this that we're all going through? How important of a reminder is it to take each moment kind of as it comes and not to get lost in not to get lost in the future, or not to get stuck in the past, but to sort of just face the issues that the pandemic brings, some of the other issues that were talked about, whether we find it in politics or our public discourse or anything like that, taking that moment, each one as it presents itself. How important has that been to you, and how have you dealt with that?
Gosh, I think it's been the way through for me. I really don't think that, I don't know how I would have gotten through each day without that focus on really one thing at a time.
I'm wondering if you could read a little bit from your piece, "Hope Is This Moment."
Sure. It's a shorter one, so I can actually read all of it. And it is a free verse poem. So, "Hope is one cup of sugar, one stick of butter, my pandemic anxiety firmly packed, brown sugar, applesauce. Time to mix. She's 11 now, no longer so excited about this cookie making business. At age 4, she burst with delight. Tonight's motivation is product, not process. Still, I'll take it gratefully. 2 cups of flour, baking soda, salt, more mixing. Good job, remember to scrape the sides." She nods. "Hope is when we pour the chips." She steers the spatula through thick batter, making sure chocolatey goodness reaches every single cookie. "Hope is sliding the tray in the oven, closing the door, waiting. Smells good," says my husband, and her teenage brothers emerge from their rooms. Hope is this moment. Standing in the kitchen together, the 5 of us, bustling, talking, laughing, pouring milk, I savor the warmth and the sweetness, and maybe even a cookie.
I love that. I just love it. You hear the first few, I don't know anything about poetry, so I don't know what they're called, but you hear the first few lines, the first few ingredients or processes that you're, as you're going through your recipe, and you think it's going to be a poetic reading about making cookies, and you find out the whole thing is about relationship, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, and relationships have turned out to be so important as people have dealt with pandemic stress, pandemic grief, pandemic everything else. We've all, those of us who are fortunate to live among others, have found ourselves turning to our loved ones we agree with, loved ones we disagree with, and finding different ways to be together. Is how has your family, you mentioned, you know, your kids in that poem, your husband, they're all part of that cookie process. How have you all found changes in your relationship to one another through this pandemic couple of years?
Gosh, similar to Amanda. So my husband is in education as well. So we were all home together during that time. And I think that, you know, when it first started out, it was sort of like when we're all together, you know, on a holiday break, we were doing lots of family game nights and we were spending a lot of time together, you know, family movie nights. And then I think we realized that, gosh, we all need our space too. So, you know, then we kind of navigated how to have that time together, but also make sure that really as a family made up mostly of introverts, that we were having that time apart to be able to re-energize as well. So it was a balance. I think, you know, we learned a lot about each other just because we were spending so much more time together. And I think even navigating, you know, for my three children, online school and not having the same connections they had with their friends that they were used to, all of that taught us a lot about each other. I think we grew in lots of ways because of it.
That's Tracy Schulte-Hellickson, who's just read us her poem, Hope Is This Moment. Matt Cashin is a professor at UW La Crosse and an author, and has written in this book, Hope Is the Lost Peanut Floating Down the Kickapoo, which we heard about a moment ago. Matt, would you share part of your piece with us?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Ezra. I cut a couple of paragraphs out of the middle, but maybe nobody will notice. So hope is a lost peanut floating down the Kickapoo. Hope? You want hope? I'm usually a cups half full kind of guy, but through the first half of 2020, just days before the deadline, my overly hopeful editor imposed for this assignment, my cup was not only empty, it was missing. My wife Heather and I loaded our kayaks and drove to Vernon County to look for it. We stayed overnight with our friends Jean and Terry Beck on their 40-acre farm. Edith, their 6-year-old granddaughter, was there. The next morning, she bounced on the trampoline while I watched from a nearby lawnmower, gripping the wheel, pretending to race away. It doesn't work, she said. Well, let me ask you this, I said. Why did the chicken cross the road? She recited the obvious, but I dug deeper, searching for some philosophical truth. Why, I said again. To get to the orchestra, she said. Okay, I said. And also to go to church, she said. Okay, I said. And to join the chicken choir and play saxophone, I offered. Yes, she said. And also to go to McDonald's for French fries and arugula, she said. Yes, I said. And also, she said, to get away from the coyote's shadow. Oh, I said. I paused. I said, do you think a coyote would eat a cat? No, Edith said. Too many ticks. Later, the water took us down the 2,000-year-old rock cliffs that line the Kickapoo River. I remembered how small I was then. We coasted beneath bridges where hundreds of barn swallows sprang from nests and swarmed in circles because we were trespassing. We moved through this primitive and quiet place that cradled the sun, an ancient sanctuary that has weathered floods and droughts and will continue to endure. Situated between her grandparents in their canoe, Edith pulled out a bag of snacks and turned to me in my trailing kayak. I asked what she was eating. Peanuts, she yelled. I'm putting one in the water so it will float to you. The current took it the opposite way. Thank you, I yelled at her. My cup found and full.
That's nice. The part I was particularly drawn to is all of the different reasons the chicken crosses the road.
Well, she knew them all, I think.
Well, any of us who have children in our lives know there's a new one every day, right? It's just and And it's we think we have so much to be wrapped up in and so much more important to do, and then all of a sudden we're in this moment where the most important thing you can do is ponder all of the reasons that a chicken would cross the road.
Yes, and I mean, I was so inspired by her imagination, of course, which makes me want to go back and take more notes so I can write another story. You know, I'm sure she has thousands more since then.
Write another story. BJ can give you another deadline. There you go.
Yes, I need those. Maybe a little more latitude this time, BJ.
It's a service I provide, so you're welcome.
That's Matt Cashin. We also heard before from Tracy Schult-Hellickson. BJ Hollers is the editor of Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. Amanda Ziba is still with us, and our conversation will continue after a quick timeout. If you've missed part of our show today and would like to listen, you can find all of them online. They're at wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. The program continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. We're talking about Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. It's a collection of some 100 different essays, poems, pieces about how different artists, authors in Wisconsin have reflected on the pandemic years that we've been through. The editor of that work is BJ Hollers. He's with us now. BJ, you wrote the introduction to this piece. It's a piece called Hope is One Foot in Front of the Other. And I definitely think we've heard that kind of reflected in what different people have had here to say. I want to talk, before we get too far down the road, about where people can find this book if they're interested in reading it.
Too far down this road, a very nice segue for One Foot in Front of the Other.
There
well
we
played,
go.
Ezra.
There we go. I swear I did it on purpose.
well done. Wherever books are sold, certainly lots of online options, but local bookstores are always the preferred option. So wherever you buy your books locally, go for it.
And yeah, as I'll say, in La Crosse, I know that Pearl Street Books is stocking the books. So yeah,
oh good,
go right by, step on in.
Pearl Street Books is in one of my favorite buildings. All those buildings downtown are so fantastic, and all the little independent bookstores in the small towns around us, I'm sure, have it as well. And I've seen it online. And BJ, if somebody wants to look it up, who's the publisher of the book?
It's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
Okay, good. Amanda Ziba is with us. Amanda, in addition to teaching, is the as I said before, the purveyor of Word Nerdopolis. That has nothing to do with this book, but I'm just curious about it. Tell me about Word Nerdopolis.
I like to do all sorts of things when it comes to words, you know, reading, writing, teaching, and I was trying to come up with a way to like convey all of that, like, and Word Nerd rhymes, so that's fun. And so I will often, you know, say I'm a self-proclaimed word nerd. And when I wanted to redo my website, someone suggested to me, you know, like, what kind of a building would you have? Like in, you know, like if you were a brick and mortar place, like what kind of building would it be? And I was like, well, it's more like a city. Like there's like a lot of different buildings. Like there's, you know, there's the post office where you could send me a letter, you know, thus Hope is the Thing I deliver. There's a school where I have all my educational resources, and there's a gym where writers can get their workout, and there's a movie theater for all my YouTube videos. And so it's like my own little corner on the internet.
Your piece in Hope is the Thing is called Hope is the Thing That I Deliver. Hope is the Thing I Deliver. You've told us a little bit about it earlier. Why don't you read part of it for us now?
Absolutely. Hope is the Thing I Deliver. When I was in middle school, I spent an exorbitant amount of time writing notes. Not the studious kind, the tween communication lifeline kind. These notes would be written in rainbow of colors, expertly folded in complex patterns, and then delivered surreptitiously between classes. Each note was proof of a tangible connection in a sometimes hostile and unpredictable land. I kept the notes I received buried deep in my closet inside a plastic jug that once held animal crackers. When I left home for college, I threw them away in the name of moving on, but not before unfolding and rereading every single one to relive the awkwardly magical times. I shouldn't have been surprised when I returned to letter writing when the quarantine rolled around. During the days of the stay-at-home order, my family and I relied on words to keep our social hearts happy. Each morning, I'd walk out to the mailbox and place in a handful of hope and then put up the little red flag. For months, we traded pen pal letters with friends, sent cards to family members, and drew pictures for classmates. I'm not a healthcare worker, nor can I sew a mask. I couldn't visit my grandfather or smile at my coworkers. I couldn't meet my friends for coffee. But the one thing I could do was write letters. I could deliver hope one stamp envelope at a time. And here's the thing about hope. It comes back around. For the brief moment it takes to open the door of my mailbox and peer inside, I'm uncertain of what I'll find. I'll go days with nothing but bills, but then, just when it seems like the mail service only delivers responsibilities and bad news, a bright envelope shows up with my name scrawled in recognizable handwriting. Hope.
That's really nice. I like that. When you talked about the tangible connection, the physical act of writing something to someone is because the mail's full of, you know, junk and bills and other garbage and whatnot, and to flip through it and see something that it's almost like somebody sending you part of their soul in a way.
Yeah, totally.
So tell me about when you would send letters to people. Are you like does that become like a whole thing? Are you like crafting little cutout stuff and taping and gluing and all this sort of thing, or are you just like scribbling on paper and sending it on the way as quick as you can?
It depends on who's getting it. You know, if the person receiving the letter appreciates that kind of thing, or like, if my sons and I were very bored and we needed, you know, a craft or an activity, it would include that. You know, oftentimes, like when I'd send letters to my nieces and nephews, we'd get stickers, you know, and send those. But sometimes it's just the simple card, you know, and it's more so, I think, even than the physical item of the card, it's the fact that somebody thought of you and they took a little time to think of you and send something your way.
You mentioned the sons. So this became a family activity?
Yes. Yes. So I mentioned before, my husband's a teacher, and Tracy and I, our lives like crisscrossed so many ways. We were meant to be friends because like her husband, my husband is a college coach at UWL actually. And so when the pandemic hit, it's normally baseball season. And so he normally works like 80 hours a week during the season, his full-time job and then coaching. And so normally March, April, May, we don't see him like at all. And now all of a sudden we were all home together all the time. And so while some people, you know, talk about all the struggles and the very hard things, we felt lucky because we had like a 2 month, you know, time where we didn't go anywhere but hang out with each other. So yeah, we did a lot of things all together. Like Tracy said, you know, family movie nights. We had happy hour every day at 3:30 and played Rummy Cube with snacks. So yes, my sons got into the pen paling as well. It was great.
Talking about compiling this book, BJ, you said the pieces just came pouring in when people heard of the idea. Your contribution to this, in addition to the editorial work, which is no small feat, is an introduction called "Hope is One Foot in Front of the Other." Would you share a little bit of that with us today?
Absolutely. And it was a tough challenge after reading 100 fantastic submissions for the book. I mean, what's left to write about, you know? So I went with something small, something humble as well.
So you wrote this after you had already, like, had the book already been assembled? Like, did you have it in order and all the work was pretty much done and then you contributed the introduction?
Yes, because I wanted to speak in later parts of the introduction about kind of some of these themes we've discussed today and how the book evolved and how it changed as the months went on. And so I wasn't sure how to fit those passages together until we had that final product. But this was one constant throughout the pandemic, and it's continuing on till today, in fact. So that's what I'll be reading about now. Shortly before sunrise, I strap my 7-month-old daughter into her stroller and take to the sidewalks around our western Wisconsin home. For 3 months now, this has become our ritual, our anchoring to the earth. We strike out for several miles, observing no humans, but instead the natural world grown bold. And not just backyard critters. Sure, we see the squirrels and the rabbits, but some days we see deer too, traipsing down the streets, bowing their heads between the neighbors' gardens. They sample all that has sprouted, chewing noisily before continuing their movable feast. If the deer see us, their recognition hardly registers. Perhaps they sense that we are no threat. Hope for them is a patch of fresh flowers and no one to shoo them away. Hope for me is sharing with my daughter, who's been quarantined half her life, any glimpse of the world we can get. Leaning low beside the stroller, I whisper the name of those creatures just ahead of us. Deer, I say, deer. Her eyes widen, her world expands. Sometimes hope is a humble thing. Lately, we've been venturing further, and as our miles increase, so too do our interactions. By sunup, the wildlife begins to give way to our fellow humans, most of whom walk alone or in pairs, and many of whom are masked. Under such conditions, I can't see their smiles, but I can feel them. We demonstrate our affection for one another by other means, most notably the wide berths, which have now become so commonplace, steering ourselves from the sidewalks like some terrestrial version of synchronized swimming. None of us need to say anything for our message to be clear. By way of our detouring, we are telegraphing empathy, acknowledging shared responsibility, and reaffirming humanity too. Sometimes even the humblest actions are hopeful. One morning, as a walker and I engaged in the awkward who goes which way shuffle, we both found ourselves laughing at an experience that seemed equal parts necessary and absurd. Eventually, the walker and I worked out the details. She went left, we went right, and then we both continued on our way. But before she was out of sight, I turned the stroller around so my daughter could get a quick look at the creature just ahead of us. Person, I said, person. We continued on, one foot in front of the other, moving toward that better world.
There's we've been talking about the book. We've been talking about all the different contributions to it. And there's a very interesting opportunity for people not only to get the book, as you mentioned, at their local bookstore or in your favorite online seller if you have to. But there are opportunities for you to interact with some of the writers and to hear readings from the book in person coming up on Monday of next week. So Amanda Ziba is one of the authors we've been talking to. And Amanda, you've kind of spearheaded this this reading coming up at Western Technical College. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, we are really excited. So Monday night, November 15th, Tracy and Matt and I and another local writer, Jody Vandenberg-Daves, are going to be at Western Technical College in the Learning Commons. It's that big, beautiful, I'm gesturing like y'all can see me, like the domed building. It's beautiful. I'm so excited to have people come to our campus. But we're going to be there. And from 6:30 to 7:30, we are going to share pieces of our writing and also just kind of talk about what it's like to try to find hope in hard times and how also to write in hard times. Because, you know, Tracy kind of said a little bit earlier, at the beginning of the pandemic, she wasn't writing. And it's hard sometimes, even though you might have more time at home, to use that time for creative pursuits. So just a little bit of a panel discussion on that. And, you know, we'll take questions from people who attend. There will be books for sale there through our campus bookstore. And we're really looking forward to it. We hope that we have a great crowd of you know, some students. We hope some students come, but also friends and community members and other people from our colleges as well. So hope you can come.
Amanda Ziba is one of the contributing authors to Hope is the Thing. Amanda, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
Tracy Schult-Hellickson is one of the authors as well. Tracy, thanks for being with us on Newsmakers.
Thank you. Enjoyed it so much.
Matt Cashin is another contributor to Hope is the Thing. Matt, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ezra. This was a lot of fun. Thanks.
BJ Hollers is the editor of Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic. BJ, thank you for your work on this project and for being here on the show today.
Oh, it was an honor. Thank you all so much.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Our producer is Dawn Jewell. And there's a couple of opportunities to hear our show every week. We originate Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network, 90.3. We repeat Friday evenings at 7 o'clock on NPR News and Music, 88.9. And, of course, we're always online, wpr.org/newsmakers. Join us again next week for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.